multitude of plunder-hungry mountain men about to fall upon them. His stomach flipped over at the sight of Redbeard, leaping across the last stretch behind Atea, club raised, face agape in an animal cry. With a wild swing, Hattu hurled the rock at Redbeard's face. The warrior's bloodthirsty leer vanished in a puff of scarlet mist, a crack of nasal bone and a roar. The Kaskan fell in a thrashing mess. Hattu stooped, ducking under Atea's midriff and hoisting her across his shoulders. For a heartbeat, he was faced with the rest of that tidal wave of frenzied creatures from the northern mountains, before he pivoted round with a puff of dirt and dust and lumbered as best he could towards the postern tunnel. A rain of stones, spears, and thrown axes battered the rim of the tunnel as he rushed inside, the three-legged farm dog coming with them. For a moment, there was nothing but near blackness and the odour of musty damp air, alive with the clatter of his feet and weak cries from Atea. Then his eyes adjusted, with a little help from the pale, algae-streaked wash that coated the corridor walls and smooth floor. The passageway was just high enough for him to carry Atea without ducking, leading them under the walls and into the city. Footsteps rapped, his own and many heavier ones in pursuit. His breath came in panicked gasps. The pursuing Kaskan's breaths came with anticipatory growls, one of them scraping an axe along the wall as he went, filling the postern with the most awful demonic screech. "Hattu!" Atea wailed, the tremor in her voice enough to tell the story of the swiftly gaining Kaskans behind.
"I will draw out your guts while you still live, Hittite scum!" the lead pursuer said in an acid hiss.
Hattu put everything into his run, his grey eye fixed on the bright triangle of light ahead. With a sequence of loping strides, he spilled out and into blinding daylight again, just inside the lower town wall. Instantly, a group of citizens pulled down a pair of heavy, bronze-strapped gratings over the postern opening, a pursuing Kaskan slamming against it a trice later, only to be driven back by a pole thrust through the grate. Moments later, and he and Atea would have been stuck in that tunnel. All around him was chaos. He staggered, barged one way and another by a frantic contraflow of rushing bodies, deafened by screams and shouts from every lane and building in the lower town.
"The dread lord of the mountains is here, at our hallowed walls!"
a priest screamed, aloft upon the balcony of a nearby shrine. Hattu's veins flooded with ice water.
"Pitaga is here," he gasped.
The certainty that Father and Muwa were right now in the land of Wihina, putting that rogue down, now crumbling like stale bread.
"How can it be?"
Atea was wrenched from his shoulders by two women in the swaying crowds.
"She has turned her ankle. Take her to the healer. Take her deep into the city, far from the walls,"
Hattu cried, as the women carried her off. And she was gone. Just then, from the muffled din of roars outside the walls, a sharp thrumming noise cut through. An instant later came the punch of something hard and sharp hitting something else soft and wet. A shadow passed over Hattu as a sentry flailed backwards, swatted from the wall tops, a Kaskan axe embedded in his breast. He landed with a crunch on his back before Hattu, shuddering, convulsing, shield and spear falling from his dying grasp, thick gouts of blood pumping from the atrocious wound. The stricken soldier's wide eyes met Hattu's, his dying look one of confusion and terror. All around them, a rapid, irregular drumming struck up, a storm of missiles from the Kaskan masses battering down into the lower town streets. Axes, rocks, slingshot, javelins and blazing pitch-soaked arrows. In every direction, the hail mowed down bodies. A goat shot through the eye and an innkeeper struck in the throat. A woman fell, back peppered with arrows. A young girl dropped dead, struck on the head by a rock, and a man pierced by a pitch arrow ran, screaming, ablaze like a living torch. When a javelin stabbed into the ground by Hattu's feet, he stumbled back, seeing that few, too few, sentries were upon the walls. A company of 100 at most along the Tawinian gatehouse and the abutting sections of Curtain Wall. Most were pinned, crouched behind the merlons, their hide shields taking a battering from the hail. A dozen more were struck down in a bloody mizzle, one pirouetting from the defence, face torn open by a slung pebble, hair and limbs flailing, his dark red leather helm flung from his crown. And then came a far uglier hail, A cascade of severed Hittite heads, tossed from the tips of Kaskan's spears, came thudding down, rolling through the dust, long hair flipping as they went. Hundreds upon hundreds of them. One came to a halt by Hattu's foot. A soldier of the northern watchtowers, he realized. Another head was a woman's, and another an elderly man's. Some of the captives carried off to Wahina. A leader of 10 barged past him, guiding his scant troop of bronze and leather-clad spearmen towards the sturdy mud-brick stairs that would take them up onto the battlements. No sooner than the captain had climbed the stairs than a thrown rock took him in the temple, crushing the bronze brow-band of his helm and cracking his skull, sending him staggering on and over the Merlon. A terrible scream sounded from outside, and a puff of red shot up where he had landed in the Kaskan swell. The rest of his 10 climbed onto the walls more guardedly, but an instant later a clatter of timber on baked mud brick sounded as ladder tops swung into view along the battlements, shuddering and creaking, the Kaskan cries growing louder, nearer. Hattu's body was racked with a shuddering fear that came in waves, each more violent than the last. His mouth drained of every last drop of moisture as he backed away, sensing the swell that was about to burst into view over the wall. He looked behind him, across the ambar and halfway up the Acropolis Mount to the noon spur and the great barracks. Where was Kurunta One Eye and the garrison regiment? Surely the bell had been heard there, too. Surely! Suddenly, he recalled the whispers of drunk men near the open tavern by the ambar.
The king gouged out Kurunta's eye. One day the vengeful one will have his redress.
An animal cry sounded, and Hattu turned back to the wall as the first of the Kaskans leapt from the ladder tops and onto the battlements with an ululating shriek. The man's copper sword struck across the back of one Hittite warrior, blood blossoming across his long white cloak from the strike before he fell to one knee. He tried to rise, but a torrent of crimson boiled from the wound, and he collapsed. Many more Kaskans flooded onto the wall tops, and the meager resistance crumbled. As the enemy began rushing down the wall stairs and dropping down into the lower town, only paces from Hattu, the few Hittite soldiers there were quickly dispatched. Hattu backed away, overcome with fright. And then a mighty boom shook the air. Hattu saw the ancient Tawinian gates shudder, dust crumbling from the gatehouse's mud-brick upper, the few sentries holding out up there disappearing under a hail of missiles. Boom! Again. Now the gates bulged violently, and a spidering crack shot across the curtain wall either side, chunks of plaster toppling into the town and Merlons breaking off and falling outwards. Boom! With a shredding crunch and a shower of splinters, the bronze tip of a ram burst through. Another few strikes, and the famous old gates would be kindling.
"Pull back! To the Spirit Bridge!"
one voice yelled. Hattu saw a Hittite soldier, face and tunic smeared with dust and blood, standing atop one home, waving the citizens and the few remaining wall guard back from the fray, towards the thick bridge that crossed the river Ambar. It would serve as a bottleneck, a last redoubt to prevent the Kaskans spilling through the lower town entire and up towards the royal Acropolis.
"Fall back to the Brit!"
The soldier's words ended with a wet gurgle, as a spear whooshed up and tore into his chest. A gout of blood leapt from the soldier's mouth as he clutched at the shaft. Then he pitched from the roof and crunched onto the ground. Moments later, a trio of flaming torches were hurled into that building, and the home was swiftly ablaze, the skyline stained orange and undulating in the heat of the blaze.
Crash!
And the Tawinian gates burst inwards. Kaskans flooded into Hattusa's streets. Hattu spun and ran, hairing along the main way. Shooting glances behind, he saw Kaskan warriors loping along in his wake. He dipped his head and put everything into his flight. But when a dull whirring grew louder and louder, he looked back once again, only to pull his head to one side, the spinning dirk aimed for the back of his skull, shearing a lock of hair and whirling on into the side of an abandoned ox cart. The streets were thick with Kaskans now. They threw over bread and grain carts and pinned down women, tearing off their gowns and deaf to their pleas for mercy.
"Hittite dogs!"
One warrior roared in aspirant throaty breath as he knelt on the chest of an old market trader, hoisting a weighty rock, then bringing it down, crushing the old man's head like a watermelon. There was one who stood out like bronze studs in a leather shield, fiery bearded, broad and tall, clad in a black leather cuirass and crowned with a fearsome lion skull helm. Pitaga, Hattu realized at once. This was the ambitious lord who had united these oft-infighting mountain people. Pitaga stalked forward steadily. He carried a double-headed axe, twirling it with devious intent. The lord of the mountains caught Hattu's eye, and the murderous look was enough to throw his stride. Catching his toe on a flagstone, Hattu was catapulted to the ground, smacking down on his jaw and shoulder and then rolling. Dazed and prone, he shook his head and tried to right himself, only for his spinning vision to come together and sharpen on the sight of Pitaga astride away from him, axe rising, the baleful eyes complemented by a yellow-toothed rictus. The axe blade hammered down for Hattu's thigh. He swung his leg back just as the blade shattered the flagstone underneath, sending up a shower of dust and stone across Hattu's eyes. Blinking, he staggered to his feet.
"It is you!" Pitaga said, grinning a hunter's grin as his gaze flicked between Hattu's odd eyes. "The climbing boy, the cursed son of King Masili, the progeny who shames him so."
Hattu stumbled backwards, the words gripping his darkest doubts like black roots.
"Perhaps it would be more fun if I were to leave you breathing for now,"
he said in a mocking tone, then stamped forward and sharply thrust his head down and forward like a ravening vulture, nose to nose, so Hattu could smell his fetid breath, the lion fangs on his helm touching Hattu's face.
"Run,"
he hissed, then brought the back of his hand across Hattu's cheek. Hattu's head filled with a shower of lights as the brute's knuckles raked across his face. He scrambled and sprinted on up the main way, his mind in pieces, as Pitaga's tormenting cackle rang out behind him. His cheek felt like it was on fire and seemed set to burst. He ran and ran, oblivious to the chaos all around him. But one voice cut through the din.
"Help! Help!"
it cried from one side of the street. Hattu saw there the doorway of a house, blocked by an abandoned cart. A boy's face peered out from within, his eyes wide like an owl's. Hattu noticed the lad's gaunt, plague-scarred features and thin, slicked-back hair. It was the one who had recoiled in derision from him at the city gates in spring, as he and Muwa had come in from the woods.
"Please,"
the boy begged. Hattu grabbed the cart by the handles and hauled it clear. The boy scrambled out.
"Run!"
Hattu pushed him to get him going.
"Thank you,"
the boy panted, then melted into the lanes with the many other panicking citizens. Hattu ran too, black smoke scudding across his path until he finally came within sight of the short, wide spirit bridge. Not a soul stood there waiting to defend the choke point. Nothing. Nobody. Just a cacophony of screaming and shouting on the far side, and the fleeting glimpses of citizens rushing to and fro, generally on up the main way towards the noon spur and the Acropolis and the protection those heights might offer. Panicked, heartsick, he ran across the bridge, looking this way and that as he went, the din of the pursuing Kaskans rising swiftly behind him.
"Father, Muwa, where are you? The enemy is here in our home!"
Hattu was halfway across the bridge when the thunder came. From further up the main way sounded a low, dull clatter of boots moving rapidly in time, the source obscured by the kink in the road and the rising maze of houses hugging the way's sides. Hattu slowed, wondering if he was about to run into a second wave of Kaskans coming through the other side of the city. The air around him thickened and crackled, like in the moments before a storm. Then a single voice, a noise like a bellowing ox, split the air.
"Men of the storm! Raise your weapons!"
Hattu stumbled onto the southern banks, awestruck at the cry. Then came the reply, a deep, reverberating cry of 1,000 voices that caused the bridge and the streets of Hattusa to shiver.
"Tahunda, god of the storm, coat my heart in bronze!"
Like a pack of baying hunters they came at a jog, round the bend in the main way. Hittite spearmen,
their pointed leather helms jutting, faces fixed in animal rictuses, dark hair in tails that jostled and lashed behind them like those of angry lions, bodies clad in stiffened linen or bait leather cuirasses, shields bound in dark leather or raw black and white cattle skin. Covering them neck to thigh, spears trained like fingers of judgment. 20 wide they filled the road, and 40 such ranks advanced in perfect order behind them. Crunch, 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 the rapid din of their upturned leather boots was unrelenting. The rightmost soldier on the front rank held aloft a wooden staff topped with a golden lightning bolt, the symbol of the Storm Division. One figure broke through to run proud of their front, head dipped, lone eye ablaze, silvery braid swishing, teak-hard chest bulging under his leather crossbands. Hattu tried to get out of Karunta's path, but could not escape his gaze.
"You!" Karunta gasped. "Get back, boy! Back!"
He swiped a hand towards the side of the main way. That was enough to send Hattu stumbling out of their way, letting the lone regiment of the Storm Division take up its position, spilling onto the near half of the bridge like a plug. At the same time, a clutch of storm archers burst into view, clambering like spiders from a disturbed nest up onto the rooftops around the bridge, around 200 in all. With no armour or weapons bar their composite bows and twin quivers looped over their backs, they were spry and sped into position on the lips of those roofs within moments, knocking arrows to their bows, those nearest the edges kneeling so others behind them could stand and shoot too. From the southern banks, Hattu watched, panting, as the wall of spearmen slowed to a walk on the centre of the bridge. Karunta stepped up on the wooden rail on the side of the bridge, flush with the front line, reaching over his shoulders with both hands to draw out and raise the twin curved blades there. He reprised that ox-like howl once again.
"This sacred bridge must be held!" he cried.
Just as they had moved in unison, they stopped as one, a wall of shields and spear tips blocking the wide bridge as firmly as any stone redoubt. Then he gestured to the archers on the rooftops.
"Shoot down any hairy hurkler who tries to ford the river!"
With a vociferous roar, the caskins now exploded into view and flooded onto the northern end of the bridge, erupting in a thunderous roar. Pitaga remained a safe distance back, climbing atop the side of a stone cistern and pointing his double-headed axe like a preacher's finger.
"Where is your great king? Your Labana, your son!"
Pitaga cried out, as if the city of Hattusa itself was listening.
"Oh, he's chasing my shadow far away in Wahina!"
he bellowed, with laughter, then continuing in a gurgling cry, swinging his axe forth.
"Forward! Topple their temples, take their treasures, spill their blood! Leave their sacred city no more than a dark stain, like the rubble heaps that are Zalpa, Hakmis, and Nerik, upon whose soil my pigs now shit!"
The caskins surged across the bridge with a roar.
"To the dark earth with these dogs! To the dark earth!"
Karunta screamed, his din just besting the enemy cry before it was drowned out in a riotous clash of bronze blades, clanging upon the bridge's midpoint, men screaming, shields sparring, and the crisp whistle of many arrows being loosed from either bank. Hattu watched as the two forces vied for possession of the bridge like herds of clashing bulls. Hittite spearmen lashed their lances forth without mercy, the leaf-shaped tips splitting Kaskan armour, plunging into enemy throats and limbs. The Kaskans were no less fierce, their axes swinging rapaciously, crushing Hittite skulls, gouging into shoulders and cleaving men's bodies deeply, so deep that the blood that spurted from the wounds was black, not red. Pitaga waved more and more warriors onto the bridge. As the Kaskan push intensified, the storm soldiers suffered, being driven back one step and then another. One Hittite sank to his knees, blood erupting from his nose and mouth and an axe embedded in his forehead. Another toppled like a felled log, sideways, pitching over the side of the bridge and plunging into the ambar, turning the sacred waters red as he floated face down towards the culvert by the shattered Tawinian gates. Suddenly,
A stray Cascan arrow skated off the flagstones of the main way, just by Hattu's ankle. He ducked down behind an abandoned potter's cart, then edged his head out to glance across the water. Over 100 Cascans were wading across the river under the covering shots of their archers. Hattu's blood was suddenly laced with cold realization. The bridge was about to fall, and the river was close to being traversed. He edged his head out from the cart again, and saw a braid-bearded wading Cascan in the near shallows just a few paces away. The warrior locked eyes on Hattu, turning his blood to ice.
"Loose!"
the Hittite archer captain yelled from the roof of the smith's workshop. A moment later, a concerted volley spat down upon the near Cascan and the others following. With a series of thumps, thuds, and groans, many slumped into the water and were carried off downriver by the gentle current. The braid-bearded giant took an arrow in the cheek. Blood tumbled down his face and beaded in his beard. The huge warrior somehow waded on for a few paces, as if his body was slow to register the mortal strike, before he too succumbed and sank into the water. Suddenly, the few unhurt warriors mid-river slowed, doubting the wisdom of their approach, abruptly deaf to Pitaga's cries of encouragement from the far bank. And, in that same instant, like a changing wind, the clash on the bridge turned too. Hattu saw Karunta in the midst of it, leaping in battle fury, shieldless, his silvery braid of hair swinging. He elbowed a Cascan in the face before turning on his heel to drive one curved blade into the collarbone of a stocky foe and then bring the other sword slashing across the belly of a sprightly one. Three splashes sounded as this doomed trio staggered to the edge of the bridge and fell into the river. He saw Karunta's face contort, mouth agape as he cried encouragement to his soldiers. Over the din of dying men and clashing weapons, he could not make out the words, but he saw that they certainly worked. For just a heartbeat later, the Cascan push faltered, and the Hittites edged forward. But then a hand slapped on his shoulder. Hattu felt his heart leap into his throat. He swung round in fright, only to see Sarpa, panting, shaven head beaded with sweat, having hobbled from the walls of the storm temple.
"Brother, you should have stayed in the temple strong room."
"I was on the temple roof and I saw you out here so close to the fray," Sarpa said, his eyes darting over Hattu, one hand reaching up to trace over the swollen, grazed cheek where Pitaga had struck him.
"I'm fine,"
Hattu insisted, pushing his brother's hand back from the stinging wound.
"And the Cascans are losing, look."
A few snatched breaths passed, and, true enough, the first Hittite step forward became a second, then a third. Soon they were almost at a slow, grim march, the front rank a blaze of jabbing spears and curved swords. Karunta leapt clear of the push, up onto the bridge's edge again, driving them on with his words and his pointing blades.
"Forward!"
"Some thought King Masili was a fool when he set off for Wahina and left Karunta behind," Sarpa grinned. "But I doubt they will question his loyalty again. He saved our city."
Hattu saw Pitaga on the far bank. The Lord of the Mountain's hubris was draining, head switching in every direction for some way of turning the tide.
"Still, you're right. We should draw back," Hattu said.
But before the words were fully out, he saw Pitaga lift a small throwing axe, then, with a flash of bronze, hurl it across the ambar.
"Sarpa!"
Hattu cried. But his brother was too slow to move. The axe spun and hammered into the back of Sarpa's neck, wedging side on and deep, just above the collarbone. Sarpa staggered, honey-gold eyes wide in shock. Black blood pumped from the awful wound in gouts, and Sarpa's head tilted to one side, almost peeling away from his shoulders, his dying breath coming as a choked rasp.
"Brother!"
Hattu cried, lunging forward to halt Sarpa from toppling down into the ambar. A hot shower of blood sprayed over Hattu's face and torso, the coppery reek branding itself on his memory forever. His brother's blood-slick body slid clear of his grasp and crashed into the waters. Hattu fell to his knees, hearing the Cascans roar in delight as Sarpa's corpse was carried out into the center of the ambar.
"We have the head of a prince as our prize,"
he heard Pitaga howl from across the water. In a blur of tears, he saw the Cascan leader's men over there poking their spears into the current,
then hooking poor Sarpa out like a fish, hoisting him. Pitaga seized the body by the scruff of the collar and brought his great double axe slicing down to sever the last tendons that held Sarpa's head in place. The Kaskan lord held the Hittite prince's head aloft, and he and his men howled as if it was some sort of victory. Yet it was short-lived, as their attempt to take the spirit bridge crumbled moments later. In a trice, Pitaga had turned away from the river with his prize, fleeing with his personal guards. A moment later, and the last resisting Kaskans on the bridge broke too, turning, all sense of cohesion vanishing as they spilled back from whence they came, some trampling or barging comrades out of the way. Pursued by the men of the storm, the remnant of the horde was soon just a dull rabble, surging back into the black smoke clouds of the lower town ward, charging through the ruins they had created, leaping over the dead they had stolen life from, fleeing through the ruined Tawinian gate. A breath of wind swept some of the smoke away and revealed the full extent of the dancing fires, the wrecked mass of blackened or part-tumbled homes, and the broken gates and listing cracked walls. Hattu saw the three-legged dog, pining, tail wagging in forlorn hope as it stood over the prone, still form of its owner. He saw Sarpa's body and the red mess at the end of his neck.
"They took his head,"
he whispered, realizing he was shaking badly. He barely noticed the figure striding towards him. Karunta's mottled skin was lashed with blood. Steam coiled from his bald scalp and torso as the sweat of battle began to evaporate. If this wasn't fearsome enough, his face was a crumpled ball of fury.
"Boy, what in the name of Tahunda were you doing? I told you to get back. A moment later and..."
His words ended abruptly as he saw the runnels of redness dripping from Hattu's face, soaking his tunic.
"Prince Hattu,"
he said in alarm.
"It is not my blood. I am unhurt,"
Hattu said with a tremor, then pointed across the river to the headless corpse.
"But Prince Sarpa is dead," he wailed.
Rivulets of Sarpa's blood snaked from Hattu's person, through the shingle and into the Ambar's waters.
"My brother is dead."
Karunta took a step back, his breath caged and his good eye wide as he realized what had happened.
"By all the gods, no. It will begin on the day he stands by the banks of the Ambar."
Hattu looked at the gnarled general, confused.
"Soaked in the blood of his brother,"
Karunta finished, his face draining of color. Chapter 5. Shield of the King, Late Autumn, 1303 BC. Red dust rose from the age-old track like an ethereal serpent into the crisp blue morning sky. Almost 9,000 men marched southwards along it, back into the Hittite heartlands. They went without their armoured vests, carried instead in the mule and ox-cart train, but wore their bronze and leather helms and carried their spears and shields still, as Hittite martial code demanded. Leather bags of rations and personal effects, tied near the tops of their spear tips, swung, and they alternated between chants of prayer and coarser marching songs. The singing stopped when they came to a clay altar by the left side of the route. The commanders bellowed an order to halt, and the regiments obeyed, taking time and care to leave small portions of bread by the altar, gifts to the god of the road, and a ruse to trap the evil spirits that many said lingered on that side. Others sent prayers up to the familiar hills ahead, for they were but a few weeks' march from Hattusa, from home. Up on the clifftop that overlooked the procession of his army, two gleaming Mercedes stood guard by the royal carriage, a sturdy bronze-banded cedarwood wagon. King Masili himself stood at the cliff's edge, shrouded in his dark grey cloak, his silver-threaded locks dancing in the biting wind. An entire campaigning season gone.
"And what have we achieved?"
His bones ached in the breeze, as if demanding he become an old man before his time. He
He let his tired eyes trace the bronze-scaled serpent of the Hittite army from head to tail as it set off again. Leading the way was the Wrath of Saruma, his own division, dedicated to and named after the mountain god. Next came the Fury of Aplu, devoted to the god of the Dark Earth. Chosen Prince Muwa marched at their head, resplendent in his black garb and shining white silver cuirass. Next year would be the lad's 17th summer, and it showed. He was tall, strapping and strong, and he had certainly developed an eye for women. He had mentioned more than once how eager he was to return to Hattusa, to meet with the priestess girl. Perhaps that is why he marches at such haste, Masili chuckled. His eyes swung to the next division, the Blaze of Ariniti, division of the Sun Goddess. He could see their fine ranks and their barking captains, but could not see General Nuanza at their head.
Where is the bowman?
Behind the Blaze rode the bloated pack of sumpter mules, thousands strong, laden with bags of grain and salted meats. With them came a caravan of ox wagons carrying the dread spearhead of his army, the chariots, disassembled and strapped down to the wagon floors. A pack of 400 unburdened war stallions trotted alongside the vehicles, and the fork-bearded Hurrian chariot master Coulter walked with them, wandering amongst them, whispering to each of them like children. The horses and cars had gone unused. Wahina had been re-established as Hittite territory. A bite had been taken out of the lost north, but only because the enemy that had rampaged there the previous year was gone, like an autumnal mist. He felt a nagging, gnawing doubt, nebulous and persistent. It was like the dream that had plagued him all throughout this campaign, a dream where he wandered in an unfamiliar palace in search of the distant echoing call, Father! The call would lead him to the doorway of a room, where Ishtar would greet him with a warm smile, then direct him with an open hand to the opposite door and on along a corridor. Yet at the end of the corridor, he would find himself in the same damned room, the goddess there too, playfully guiding him down the same corridor. He grunted and shook the thought away. The mere memory of the dream maddening.
Father!
The call from the dream persevered. He thought of his youngest son, left back in Hattusa. Hot pins of guilt pricked his heart as he thought of the life he had enforced upon Hattu. He imagined his long-dead wife's face gazing at him in cold censure.
I'm sorry, Gasula. There is no other way. At least he wants for nothing, he whispered.
Nothing but his father's love,
his wife's wraith replied. Seeking distraction, he looked back whence the army had come. Wahina, that strange bare land of endless green hills. Wahina, a land of shadows. Volker the Sherden had led them to a creek, where he and his two men had heard rumour of the Kaskan masses, but ultimately those sites were as bare as all the others, and their quarry had continued to elude them. His eyes traced along the northern horizon and the jagged soaring mountains, grey-blue in the haze of distance, near impenetrable rocky fortresses where Pitaga and his growing army had no doubt retreated to.
I'll find you, you bastard.
He stopped, wincing, clutching his left arm. The shooting pain on the inside of his bicep almost blinded him, such was its ferocity.
My son.
A voice spoke behind him.
What?
He said tetchily, swinging round to glare at the two Masedi, expecting to see Zida there with some bothersome issue. But he saw it was Nuanza who had spoken. His ire faded with the pain in his arm. Few men could remain angry in the bowman's company.
I'm sorry, my friend. I was letting my thoughts get the better of me for a moment there. If it was only the odd fleeting moment, my son,
Nuanza said, striding over to stand by the king and behold the north with him.
We didn't even catch sight of him, Nuanza,
Masili snapped.
Such is the Kaskan way. They know they cannot match us on an open plain. Thus they melt into the trees and the hills and...
The veins in his temples under his V of hair stood proud.
Those damned mountains.
Masili's jaw worked, not satisfied.
In days past, they might have been content to do so year after year, raid and retreat. But those we spoke to in the shanty villages by the pillaged cities did not speak of raiding bands.
Like ants, one fellow claimed. Kaskans moving in a single drove, many thousands strong. And more than one such force, Nuanza mused. My son, what if Pitaga has managed to unite the 12 tribes? Mercili finished for him. Then he must have promised them a fine prize for them to set aside their differences. His brow pinched, and he heard that call from the nagging dream again.
Father!
Instinctively, he looked south in the direction of Hattusa. Nuanza read his disquiet instantly.
I sense something is wrong too, my son. We should hurry back to the capital.
A clop-clop of horses' hooves cut off the exchange. The pair looked up to see Volker, the horn-helmed Sherdon, riding on a mare, coming up the winding path by the cliffside to join them. The comical sight softened Mercili's hard thoughts.
Warriors do not sit on horses, man, he laughed. Messengers, scouts and boys might, but not warriors.
Volker slowed the mare and slid from his awkward sitting position on the beast's croup. He landed on the ground with a thump and stroked the mare's nose.
I am not warrior today, he said,
in his improving but still simplistic Hittite tongue, with a wide grin that exaggerated his impeccable looks, gesturing to the thin linen tunic and belt he wore.
My armor is stowed on mule train.
No armor save for the helmet, Mercili thought but did not say.
Volker had been a charismatic addition to his retinue, affable, knowledgeable, and inspirational throughout the chase to pin down Pitaga. Yet never once had Mercili or any other seen him without that nightmarish horned helm.
Hiding a bald crown? Mercili wondered with an inner chuckle.
The danger is over, is it not? Volker continued. You said we are now safely back on sacred Hittite soil, no?
Danger is pervasive, Nuanza said in a remedial tone. And we should neither be lax nor let our pace lessen.
Volker shrugged, unimpressed. Then he nodded towards the snaking army down on the ground below.
Prince Muwatali is keen to lead march back to Hattusa. I thought we could ease off on our return. Spend rest of day hunting, then follow on, he said.
Then turned away from the cliff edge and looked southeast to the run of bumpy foothills. He crouched by imprints in the dirt.
The spoor of lion. I have heard many rumors of the creatures in these lands. Deer, lynx, tigers, bulls, wolf, and boar. Elephant, even.
That smile again. Enough to convince a harlot to pay for his company, Mercili reckoned. Volker handed him a drinking skin.
I prepared some more of the Sherdon root brew for you. Drink. Wet your lips and whet your appetite for the thrill of the hunt.
Mercili took the skin and sipped on the drink. It was deliciously sweet and spicy at once, invigorating indeed. He smacked his lips in satisfaction, his eyes following Volker's sweeping hand.
It has been some time, my son, Nuanza interrupted. Perhaps a hunt could be organized for another day. It has been more than a summer since last the people saw their Labana. Think of the throne.
He hesitated before adding,
think of the soft beds and the wine. Think of the harem.
Mercili shot the master archer a fiery look that faded into a salty half-smile.
Perhaps you're right.
Volker's handsome features crumpled.
Not even a single catch? To honor gods? Did you not tell me how dark skies gather over your city when the storm god is not honored?
Mercili balked at this. It was an unwelcome seed of doubt that he knew would plague his every moment were something grim to occur. A deer hunt, perhaps, and then they could catch up with the army on the royal carriage. They could offer the beast up on the altar within the storm temple. Its meat would feed many weary mouths, so it would be no wasteful hunt. The goddess, Kamruseppa, protector of the herds, would approve.
My son, Nuanza started to protest.
Just then a faint drumming of wild hooves sounded, deep in the wooded vales of the foothills. The trees there shook. Volker's face opened up.
The hunt is on, my son.
A scent of pine spiced the air as Marsili stalked through a mesh of ferns and a frosty carpet of golden leaves and bracken, wishing away their every crackle and crunch. He silently thanked the gods for taking up Volker's suggestion. Never did the stresses of the throne drain as swiftly as when on the hunt. For the first time in so long, he felt like a boy again. Shadowing him was a lone Mercedes, like Marsili barefoot, stripped to just a tunic and carrying only a hunting spear and bow. The two halted as they heard a shuffle of leaves and bracken just beyond a small, root-knotted ridge ahead. Marsili ducked and made eyes with his guard, who indicated his agreement. Their prey was just ahead. Marsili cupped his hands together and intertwined his fingers, then blew softly, imitating the whistling melody of a song thrush twice. Silence. Even the crunching footsteps of their prey fell quiet. Then, in reply, the chirruping bird call of one of the other two hunting parties, Zeda and another Mercedes, or Volker and the two other Sheridan.
"Only one repetition," Marsili whispered to his Mercedes. "Then the beast is watching, listening," the bodyguard replied. "We must wait, my son."
An eternity passed, and Marsili's thighs began to ache. There was a rush of moving leaves, then the shuffling beyond the ridge sounded different, heavier. He was about to give the call to abandon the hunt, when at last the chirruping sounded again. Twice.
"The creature is at ease," he mouthed,
his usually pouchy, weary eyes alert and wide.
"Aye,"
his guard mouthed. Marsili rose, ghosting forward, cat soft on his feet, the Mercedes following him. They came to the tip of the rise, keeping low and as yet unable to see over it. They heard the call again, twice. Zeda and Volker's lot in position, surely.
"Ready,"
he mouthed to his guard. The fellow nodded. Marsili crouched a little lower to charge his legs with energy, made the double call to let Zeda and Volker know it was time, then sprung up and over the parapet of ferns atop the ridge. He barely heard the third muted call from the woods. At once he took it all in, a small glade, ringed with red-gold-leafed poplars and carpeted in moss. The deer was nowhere to be seen. Instead, a great grey mass dominated the centre of the clearing, ferocious ivory tusks, colossal legs, and a scarred trunk. The cow elephant, huge and very old, instantly swung its great head to face him. He realized straight away what peril he was in, seeing its calves stripping and eating tree bark. She put herself between them and him. Marsili skidded on the downward slope into the glade, arms lashing out to catch something to halt his descent. The Mercedes just behind him cried out, "My son, come back! Come back!" But Marsili could only stumble and fall to his knees in the clearing as the elephant let out a deafening, trumpeting cry, shaking its head from side to side, then stiffening its ears and tucking its trunk in below its mouth. The prelude to a charge, he realized, dread skewering his heart. The elephant thundered forward, and the ground rocked, akin to the tremors the gods sometimes cast through the earth. As the creature ate up the short distance between them, Marsili scrambled back on his heels and palms until his ankle became tangled in a vine, caught fast. The Mercedes guardsman bounded down the slope and passed Marsili in an effort to defend his king, but the elephant swished its head to the left, goring the guard through the groin with her short tusks and tossing his hemorrhaging body up and through the poplar branches. Marsili's body froze with terror as the elephant charged on towards him. The beast was but steps away when Zeda and his man burst from the trees, haring for the gap between the elephant and their king. The creature thrashed its trunk towards the Mercedes guardsman, batting the fellow off his feet, sending him crashing into a tree trunk with the thick crack of breaking vertebrae, bringing a thick shower of golden leaves toppling onto the clearing floor. Then came brave Zeda, sprinting from the far side of the glade, leaping before the creature with his spear, readied for a battle he could never win. The spry Gal Mercedes ducked the elephant's swishing trunk and leapt back from its tusks, but fell under its charge, a giant foot crushing his body on the clearing floor. "No!" Marsili wailed. Bodyguards dead, the king gawped as the elephant rose up on her hind legs, its forelegs ready to come crashing down upon him to dash him into paste. He heard a million voices sing in his head, of glory, shame, love and hatred, then swung his arms up before him like a futile shield, knowing he was bound for the dark earth. But instead of pain came a thud and a trumpeting cry from the beast. Masili prized open an eye and saw the creature, still on two legs, but now with a trident spear jutting from its left side. The cry cut right through him and gave him the strength to draw an arrow from his quiver and cut through the vine entangling him, rolling clear just a moment before the elephant's feet smashed down where he had been. He scrambled back up to the lip of the rise and watched, astonished, as now a volley of two javelins plunged into the beast's flank. It swung round to face the threat. There, in the tree line, stood Volker and his two fellow Sherdan warriors, crouched, upper bodies weaving as if ready to leap in any direction to avoid the elephant's counterattack. Having spent their spears, they now drew their swords. The elephant trumpeted once more, then tensed to charge the Sherdan pair.
"She is enraged! Do not challenge her!" Masili cried. "Separate and run!"
But the shout barely had time to leave his lips before the elephant lurched towards the trio. Masili's eyes widened, knowing the three there were as good as dead, until Volker, bounding like a deer, his handsome face spoiled by a feral grimace, leapt up and tore his trident free from the beast's flesh, then drove it up and into the creature's neck. It plunged deep, and blood sheeted from the wound. The elephant emitted one more wail, its incipient charge instantly repealed and its legs suddenly bowing and bending. As the cow crashed onto its side, Volker stalked around it, his back straight, shoulders square, nostrils flared as he glowered down his nose at the felled giant. A moment later, and the glade was still and silent, Masili descended into the clearing to stand by the elephant's corpse. Instinctively, he fell to one knee and placed a hand on the creature's forehead, between its haunted, lifeless eyes. He noticed the other two Sherdan moving over to the terrified calves, knocking their bows.
"By all the gods, lower your weapons and let them go!"
he snarled.
"My son,"
Volker said, as the two small elephants backed away, trumpeting in terror and reluctant to leave their dead mother.
"You grieve for the monster and its spawn?"
Masili spoke without looking up.
"We came for a deer. This beast has died for nothing, and the gods will not be happy. You could have let her run," he added. "If you three had parted, she would no doubt have charged into the forest and fled with her young."
Volker stalked round to the elephant's neck, placed a foot on its hide, then wrenched the trident free with a grunt, sending a puff of blood into the air.
"We could not take the chance that it might come round on you again, my son,"
he said, bowing, the faint red mizzle settling on his horned helm. Masili stood, his mind ablaze with the frantic few moments that had led to this grisly conclusion. His brow creased as he thought of the signals.
"You made the double call. Said we were good to move on the deer. Why?"
Volker's face remained blank.
"We made no call," he said,
his eyes drifting to the mangled, ruined form of Zeda, shards of white bones sticking through his pulverized, discolored body, his tunic torn, the red cloak darkened with lifeblood.
"Zeda made the call," Masili gasped.
"We saw him through woods. He made two calls to tell you to come, then became flustered and confused when he saw elephant. Didn't know how to signal danger to you. I tried to wave at him to tell him, stay silent. But he made a third call regardless, but late, almost disastrously so."
Masili felt tears welling in his eyes as he beheld Zeda's ruined body.
"He was a brother to me. Selfless. Loving. Always there."
He moved over to kneel by his chief bodyguard. A wet sigh slid from Zeda's lips. He was still alive. The Galmasedi's eyes, flooded with dark blood, rolled with great effort towards the Sherdan three.
"My son,"
he started. His lips quivered, more words trapped there on the cusp of death, before his pupils dilated and the life seeped from him and into the dark earth.
"You are my shield, my protector,"
Masili whispered, unclipping the silver hawk cloak pin from Zeda's breast and unhooking the red cloak. Volker bowed curtly in the corner of Masili's eye.
I protect you for rest of journey home, my son. I be your shield.
Masili glanced at Volker, and then at the corpses, the Sherdan's offer barely registering.
We shall bury my men. Then we shall return to the column and journey back to Hattusa before the snows come.
Volker nodded in agreement, then clicked his tongue, sending his two Sherdan warriors scampering over to begin digging. Chapter 6 Oath. Early winter, 1303 BC. The snows came early, blanketing Hattusa in a slow, relentless fall. A low cherrywood fire crackled in the center of the palace hearthroom, holding the sharp chill at bay. Hattu sat cross-legged on a goatskin rug before the ring of stone and the warming embers within. He looked up and around the walls, where the light from the fire threw flickering shadows from the red and blue painted stucco reliefs of prowling lions and imperious sphinxes, giving them life. Then, when he closed his eyes, he saw only death, that wicked collage of memories that had deprived him of sleep since the previous moon. Bearded warriors, blood, flashing blades, the screaming, the smoke, the stench. And then poor Sarpa. His head sank, and he felt tears rushing to his eyes. He caught sight of himself in the polished bronze mirror resting on the floor by the fire. His dark hair had been overly groomed by a palace barber, scraped back into a tight high knot that expanded like a jagged weed on his crown. His face was apprehensive, lips tight like the fading wheel on his cheek, the mark of Pitaga's knuckles. His immaculate white tunic, forced upon him by the eager royal tailor, itched on his skin. Soft, shuffling footsteps sounded on the stone floor. Hattu wiped his eyes and looked up.
Ah, Master Hattu,
Ruba said from the hearthroom doorway. An announcement seemed to be hanging on the old man's lips, but then the brightness in his eyes dimmed, and he seemed confused as to why he had come.
Come, sit.
Hattu gestured to the spot on the carpet by his side, eager to disguise the old scribe's embarrassment.
Warm yourself by the fire.
Ruba wandered in and sat, muttering to himself, his face sagging and anxious.
I fear my thoughts wander again. The candle does gutter.
Yet still your mind is sharper than any other in Hattusa, Hattu said swiftly and firmly. Ruba chuckled.
Sharp enough to know what is happening to me.
Hattu felt a thickening in his throat.
It could be worse, Ruba mused. I once knew a man who lived by the salt lake.
Hattu's sadness receded as the prospect of another of Ruba's entertaining tales settled on his shoulders like a warm blanket.
He was young, spry, and sharp of mind, and such a strong swimmer. He would search the freshwater estuaries to gather smooth, bright stones he could sell at the markets. While others panned for stones and metals from the banks, he knew better. He would row his raft right out to the deepest part of the water, then tie a rope around his ankle, looping the other end around a heavy rock. With a knife clasped between his teeth, he would leap overboard and let the rock pull him deep down to the bed of the estuary. He said it was like diving into a treasure chest.
Like Gilgamesh, Hattu
said with a smile.
In his quest for the thorny underwater weed that promised to restore youth.
Like Gilgamesh indeed, Ruba grinned. This diver man would fill a sack with water-polished stones, precious healing weeds, and sometimes even small ingots of gold. Then cut the rope with his knife and shoot to the surface with his haul. Then one day, before a dive, a fisherman carelessly bumped his raft. They quarreled and traded insults, but it came to nothing. And so he dived as usual, the rock taking him to the muddy bed.
Ruba fell silent again. Hattu wondered if the old man's mind had slowed once more.
And what did he find this time?
He prompted. Ruba turned to him, a wry smile on his face.
I have no idea, for he never resurfaced. They found his raft. On it was a sack with his bread and water, and his knife.
Hattu felt a chill on his skin and the urge to laugh darkly at once, imagining the diver's moment of cold realization, anchored by his own volition to the floor of the estuary, with no means of cutting the rope. Ruba arched one eyebrow.
Now, it might have been the argument with the fisherman that caused the slip, or it might have been something else. But that is forgetfulness at its worst.
Hattu peeled away the layers of the tale. Ever the pedagogue, Ruba often embellished his stories with as many lessons as possible. The detriments of a fiery temper, the foolishness of leaving only one means of escape, the folly of hubris. The old tutor had taught him so much, of the stars and the seasons, of the birds, blooms, and trees of the land, of how the soil itself, the dry ground upon which they stood, had once been deep under a great ocean. He remembered tracing his fingers over the delicate relics Ruba had shown him, impressions of shells and long-dead sea creatures in shards of rock, found right here in the hilly heartlands. Perhaps the old man's wisdom might answer the question that had been lodged in his thoughts since the Kaskan raid.
Tutor, when Sarpa was killed, General Kurunta, he was shocked, in a way I've never seen before.
The death of your brother shocked us all, Hattu, Ruba said.
No, Kurunta was saddened by what happened to Sarpa, but he seemed horrified by the sight of me standing there.
Ruba's face lengthened, like one sensing bleak weather.
He said something,
Hattu gulped.
It will begin on the day he stands by the banks of the Ambar, soaked in the blood of his brother.
Ruba's eyes slipped shut, his lips tightening.
What did he mean?
Ruba stayed silent for some time. Hattu wondered if the candle was guttering once more.
They were not Kurunta's words, Hattu. They were the words of Ishtar.
Hattu's flesh crept.
Of the goddess. Of my protector.
Every year, father had bluntly commanded him to visit the small shrine to Ishtar in the lower town. She was his protective deity, and so he would take pots of honey and wine to her altar. He thought of the great stony, lifeless eyes of the statue within, and it sent another chill through his marrow.
On the night of your birth, she came to him.
Hattu's flesh crept.
She came to him in a dream and sang him a song, Ruba said quietly. A song he never wanted to hear. A song he certainly never wanted you to hear.
What song?
Hattu snapped, fists balled, frustration rising.
Tell me!
Ruba arched one eyebrow, turning to him.
And I can understand why he is so reticent,
he chided.
The fire within you is bright. Perhaps too bright.
Hattu uncurled his fists and lowered his voice.
Please, tutor, tell me.
Ruba hesitated, then sighed.
Aye. My mind will desert me one day, and then so few will remain to tell you. Only Kurunta, Nuanza, and I know the song's words in full.
He gulped and looked around as if fearful Ishtar might be watching, before whispering,
A burning east, a desert of graves, a grim harvest, a heartland of wraiths. The son of Ishtar will seize the grey throne. A heart so pure will turn to stone. The west will dim with black boats' hulls. Trojan heroes mere carrion for gulls. And the time will come, as all times must, when the world will shake and fall to dust.
Hattu's skin tingled, colder than ever as the verse washed around in his head. What did it mean? Then he picked out one part of it, the son of Ishtar will seize the Grey Throne. The son of Ishtar? I am the son of Ishtar. These deeds are destined to be mine. Ruba sighed.
The goddess is a riddle, Hattu. You are a young man. Your actions will define your destiny.
A patter of footsteps saw a palace servant lean in from the doorway.
Master Ruba, Prince Hattu, one of General Kurunta's messenger hawks has landed at the Tawinian Gate. A grey-feathered bird.
Ruba's face lit up and he clicked his fingers.
That's what I came to tell you. Kurunta and a knot of scouts set off this morning to clear the western approaches of snow and watch out for the king's return.
Hattu's heart froze, knowing what Kurunta's grey bird meant.
The king and the army have been sighted,
he said, his voice devoid of enthusiasm.
They will be here imminently,
the servant nodded, then left. Hattu's stomach plunged. He imagined General Kurunta, out in the blizzard, telling the king all that had occurred in his absence. By now, Father would know about the Kaskan attack, and about his part in it, at a time when he should have been in the Acropolis grounds, as Father had decreed. Had he obeyed the king, then Sarpa would not have risked his life to stray from the safety of the temple strongroom. He rubbed at his eyes with a sigh.
I will ride Odix down to the Tawinian Gate and speak with him first, Ruba said,
reading Hattu's thoughts. Hattu stood.
And I will go across to the throne room for his reception, to face his anger.
Ruba cocked his head to one side, confused.
Hattu, anger is a false emotion. You know that, don't you? It is carried on truer sentiments that most men do not know how to express. The tavern brawler who fights only because he cannot bring himself